As Unitarian Universalists, we find wisdom and inspiration in many places. Jewish and Christian scriptures and other sacred texts, the arts, science, nature, our own experiences. Our tradition keeps us open to revelation from many sources. Today's wisdom comes from three very different sources describing how people in society should behave. Our first is from the state of Wisconsin's definitions for the public notary. Oath and affirmation are two very different options you can provide before being notarized. An oath. An oath is a solemn pledge attesting to the truth of given statements. An oath requires swearing and may be understood to call upon a supreme being as a witness and is subject to penalties of perjury. In contrast, an affirmation is a solemn pledge attesting to the truth of given statements. An affirmation does not require swearing, but is still subject to penalties of perjury. And now to some words from over 2,400 years ago. In the following passage, Thucydides recorded Pericles describing the Athenian system of rule. Its administration favors the many instead of the few. This is why it is called a democracy. If we look to the laws, they afford justice, equal justice, to all in their private differences. If no social standing, advancement in public life falls to reputation for capacity. Class considerations not being allowed to interfere with merit, nor again does poverty bar the way. If a man is able to serve the state, he is not hindered by the obscurity of his condition. The freedom which we enjoy in our government extends also to our ordinary life. And I think we can consider what is meant by man in this passage. Now consider the words of the poet Marge Piercy from her 1982 collection of poetry. This poem is called Councils. We must sit down and reason together. We must sit down. Men standing want to hold forth. They rain down upon faces lifted. We must sit down on the floor, on the earth, on stones and mats and blankets. There must be no front to the speaking, no platform, no rostrum, no stage or table. We will not crane to see who is speaking. Perhaps we should sit in the dark. In the dark, we could utter our feelings. In the dark, we could propose and describe and suggest. In the dark, we could not see who speaks, and only the words would say what they say. Thus saying what we feel and what we want, what we fear for ourselves and each other, into the dark, perhaps we could begin to listen. Perhaps we should talk in groups, small enough for everyone to speak. Perhaps we should start by speaking softly. The women must learn to dare to speak. The men must bother to listen. The women must learn to say, "I think this is so." The men must learn to stop dancing solos on the ceiling. After each speaks, she or he will repeat a ritual phrase. It is not I who speaks, but the wind. Wind blows through me. Long after me is the wind.
As I explored this topic, I found sources that were coming from all over. So hopefully that gives you a sense of the richness of what I was wading through, and hopefully this makes sense. So I want to start this morning with gratitude. If you have heard me up here in the past, you know that I prize my doubting nature and I try to make it useful in my life. I like to think of myself as always standing with one foot out, kind of a reverse hokey pokey, where I stick one foot in and then I stick one foot out and then I do the hokey pokey and then I go sit down, because I'm pretty sure that's not what it's all about. But this time around, I ask myself, why would you want to speak to the congregation if you only doubt? Why would you be here if you never fully commit? And I realized that I do have some faith. It is faith in the beloved community, which I witness every time I step through the doors of this building. So I thank you, and understand that I will always question, but I will always also believe. So I recently changed positions at my job. I used to be a clerk in the city clerk's office, and we administered elections. I have been replaced by somebody who's very good, though. Everything's good. But I want to tell you about something that happened over a year ago in that position. My supervisor, who directs the administration of the elections, referred to the work we did there as a sacred duty. As an atheist and a humanist, the word sacred caught my attention. As a government employee, the word was also very interesting to hear at work. The idea of the sacred is intimately linked to ideas about religion and spirituality. As I have learned to say it here, it is a type of God language. And when God language appears in our work here at REEB, I'm no longer alarmed because I know the intentions of the people that use it. I understand that the person talking about God with a capital G or with a small g, or about things that are holy or sacred, will accept my doubt, and they will see me with one foot out and know that it is not a threat or a criticism, but just the way I move through the world. Likewise, when my former supervisor talked about running elections as a sacred duty, I was at ease because I have seen what she does, and I know that she is devoted to access to the polls for any and everyone who is qualified. So I have some comfort here, a little room to muse and ponder. And this juxtaposition between the sacred and the secular, between religious and civil, reminded me a bit of our fifth principle that specifically calls for the use of the democratic process in our congregations and churches. And again, here's that sort of combining of an idea most people think is completely secular, democracy, and what happens within the walls of a religious institution. So this then took me back to my favorite search, which is for something called spiritual atheism, which I enjoy because those two words don't tend to be connected to each other either. So I may find a common thread today between all of these that I can share. My first goal was to research the sacred when it is used around elections to see how people think about this idea. And I found that the idea of a sacred duty in government is more common than you might believe. From our founding fathers to letters to the editor today, you can find it. Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson both used this idea. Letters to newspapers were a tool that were used by our early political leaders in the years before the American Revolution to sway opinions. And in a letter known as The Farmer Refuted, Hamilton makes a broad statement when he writes about New York's claim to liberty from England. And he wrote, "The sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written as with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of divinity itself and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power." So he is using the idea of the divine and the sacred to argue for political independence from another country. And in 1774, he wrote a letter to the American Daily Advertiser that states, "If it were to be asked, what is the most sacred duty and the greatest source of security in a republic, the answer would be an inviolable respect for the Constitution and laws. It is by this in a great degree that the rich and powerful are to be restrained from enterprises against the common liberty." So the sacred here is locked into the Constitution, and the Constitution and the laws that come from it are seen as a safety net against tyranny. And then Thomas Jefferson invoked the sacred when he wrote about the tyranny of the English king and his monarchy. Jefferson wrote, "He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation there. This piratical warfare, The opprobrium of infidel powers is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain. So Jefferson has tapped into the power of the sacred to push his point, along with some outrage and sarcasm that a Christian king would enslave people and take them against their will. This passage is from his first draft of our Constitution. It did not make it into the final draft, despite these rights being sacred. And during this month, which is African American History Month, we need to take a moment to recognize that this is part of our history too. So the realm of government and the realm of sacred were not clearly separated over 200 years ago. Professor Thomas Kidd from Baylor University researches religion and early American government, and he explored this, and he found a Hamilton quote as well. It looks like we all found quotes by Alexander Hamilton. And in a full vindication of the measures of Congress, Hamilton opposed British rule for a very different reason than taxes. His concern was that the British Parliament was allowing Roman Catholic religious practice in Canada. And he wrote, "How can any of you be sure you would have the free enjoyment of your religion long? Would you put your religion in the power of any set of men living? Remember, civil and religious liberty always go together. If the foundations of one be sapped, the other will fall, of course." And Professor Kidd states that the idea that civil and religious liberties are connected, that the survival of one requires the survival of the others, was found throughout colonial society. This combination might make us uncomfortable now, but it didn't at that time. The Kidd found an idea that protecting civil liberties meant that the freedom to worship remained protected. He writes, "Civil and religious liberty was a ubiquitous phrase among Americans of the era. They did not sharply distinguish between the two, for religious liberty required civil protections. They did assume, however, that religious liberty was by its nature humanity's most basic freedom." So this is an argument that it is our religions and religious practices that benefit from our secular freedoms and rights. It's a reversal of the way I was taught to understand the First Amendment, which was presented to me as protection against having these two things combined. So despite my assumption that the First Amendment separates the civil and religious, you will still find the word sacred duty used by politicians and others about political issues. In 2012, President Obama referred to our responsibility to our veterans' health, especially regarding the VA, as our sacred duty. And in 2014, Vice President Joe Biden referred to our responsibility to NATO members as a sacred responsibility. And he was referring to the NATO article that obligates member countries to come to each other's defense in the case of war. Earlier this year, four members of the group No More Deaths were found guilty of entering Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge without a permit and leaving behind personal belongings. Zachila Orozco McCormick and three others were leaving gallon-sized jugs of water for immigrants crossing the desert into the United States. According to the Arizona Republic, she said that she considered leaving water almost a sacred duty, and the judge would not or could not argue with what she named as sacred, even though it was also a political protest. He found them guilty of basically littering. So back to the idea of the sacred and the democratic process, there is a movement that has been around for a number of years that specifically tries to take the energy and determination we have doing our sacred religious work and channel it into voting. The movement is known generally as Souls to the Polls, and it is found in African American churches. The basic idea has been that the minister on Sunday encourages his parishioners to vote. The church itself organizes transportation and information about registering to vote, and hopefully this carries over to Tuesday. In Ohio, after 2005, the time between Sunday service and Tuesday voting disappeared when it became possible to vote early and possibly to vote right after church. The souls went directly to the polls. Of course, by 2014, there were partisan laws passed in Ohio stopping this early voting, and Sunday voting became an issue in the courts. However, Souls to the Poles can be found all over the country where the laws allow it to happen. And my search for ideas about government, about elections and the democratic process, and this idea of the sacred turned up numerous letters to the editor in our century right now. The pieces by Hamilton that I read were letters to the editor back in the 1770s. And now, in the 21st century, I found a piece by Dr. Leonard Zwelling in Houston, Texas. He's a doctor. And he wrote a letter to the editor describing his idea that he practices three religions. He has a spiritual religion, which is the one that most resembles church going. He has his professional religion because he's a doctor and he took an oath to protect people. And he has his national religion, which he says is being an American. And he states that the ritual he performs to practice this national religion is voting. He believes that voting is a sacred duty that we owe to our founding fathers. So despite the popular idea of the separation of church and state, mixing the sacred and the civil has been going on for centuries, and it continues today. As I mentioned, Professor Kidd found that American colonists widely agreed with this sentiment. Civil and religious liberty went together, but religious liberty was more fundamental, as it dealt with eternal matters, not just temporal ones. So what's an atheist to do? From the research I have done, it appears that our founders valued civil rights because they could protect our religious rights. And in our current time, our leaders try to reinforce our civil rights and responsibilities by appealing to the sacred, to the religious. Both connections between the two ideas place the power in the realm of the sacred. As someone who is looking for alternatives to God, language, and belief, this is a conundrum for me. The fact that we UUs bring the democratic process into our religion points to the opposite idea, that democratic principles and secular practices can strengthen our religious lives. In the future, I will explore this idea, but for today, I want to look more closely at using ritual, and specifically using non-religious rituals. All the examples I have found have been attempts to make activities and ideas so powerful that they will not be swept aside by other people or by the passage of time. Our sacred responsibility to fight wars against enemies of NATO, our sacred duty to leave water in the desert, our attempt to use the inspiration of the sacred at church to motivate people to vote, these are all examples of trying to tap into this, trying to preserve something. Our doctor, in our 21st century letter to the editor, touched on this idea that voting is a ritual, and allows me to think about our fifth principle and a way to coexist with people's attempts to mix in a dose of religious, to preserve ideas and actions. The doctor referred to voting as a ritual in a religion, but you can think of it as a secular ritual, a ritual that isn't locked into a specific religious viewpoint. When we perform a ritual here at Reeb, we are doing very specific actions, like lighting our chalice and combining it with very specific words, like our chalice lighting words. The people involved in the ritual tend to be members of the same group. It happens in a specific time and place, and we hope it'll change the world for the better. Here at Reeb, we are a little radical because we don't require membership in our group to participate. If you aren't Catholic, you can't receive the host in a church service, but anyone here can light a candle during joys and sorrows. Secular rituals include events like school graduations, parades, presidential inaugurations, the opening ceremonies of the Olympics. I would say that here in Madison, Shake the Lake or Ride the Drive could be considered to be secular rituals. Family traditions are often a type of ritual like this. If you always watch the Super Bowl in your TV watching chair, wearing your lucky Super Bowl shirt and eating your traditional cheesy popcorn and Cool Ranch Doritos, you are probably performing a secular ritual. So on to voting as perhaps a secular ritual. When you vote, and by the way, you're going to have a chance to do it on the 19th of this month, you go to a specific place, your polling place. And even if you vote early, this is done in specific locations, all Madison libraries, available now. So, And although you can early vote from a library, the truth is your ballot isn't counted until Election Day. On Election Day, those votes are delivered to your polling place, and it is only there and then that those envelopes are opened and your ballot is counted. The actual casting of your ballot still happens in a specific place on a specific day. And ritual spaces are special. They are set aside from ordinary spaces, and they have special rules to follow once you're inside them. So please remain seated. Campaigning for candidates is not allowed within 100 feet of a polling place. Firearms are not allowed in them either. When the old DMV building was a polling place, there were some conflicts because it was a state office building where concealed carry is legal, but the city was adamant that at least the voting area itself would be free of firearms, and it stayed free of firearms because ritual spaces are special and they have special rules. And there are specific times that you can vote with very particular rules about it. Voting ends at 8 p.m. However, if you are in line to vote by 8 p.m., you can still cast your ballot. Time itself is bent when you participate in the ritual of voting. There is a magic here. So, and this ritual can only be performed by initiates. Only people who have registered to vote are able to participate. If you come into your polling place on Election Day, you can register to vote then and there. So in that process, you are transformed from a member of the general public into a member of the voting public. There are specific actions to follow once you are there. You might start at the registration table, but then you move on to the poll book table. You present identification and you sign the book. I am book signed at my polling place and also here at Reeb. At this point, you're given a very special piece of paper with your voter number on it, and you might notice that this number is actually written next to your signature in the book that you have signed. If you think about the formal steps that are being taken here, they establish this sort of power of a ritual. And at the ballot table, you exchange your paper for a piece of ballot, After you've voted, you put your ballot into the tabulator, and it's there and then that you get your sticker that says, I have voted, or I voted today. And you put that on, and it's sort of a visual symbol that you have passed through the ritual of voting on Election Day. And I always found a parallel between I voted stickers and the Ash Wednesday mark that you see on people's foreheads. Now, the real power in rituals, you'll find often that the words spoken or the actions performed create a change in the world just by happening. Just by words being said, an actual change will happen. When a minister says the words, I now pronounce you married, that is when the marriage happens. The words make the change. When a judge declares that court is in session, her very words and her act of saying them makes the trial begin. When you raise your hand and swear or affirm that something is true, the words that you say are the promise itself. After you say them, you have promised, you have changed, and the world has changed. And when the clock strikes 8 p.m., one of the workers at your polling place will say loudly enough for all to hear that the polls are now closed. One time, it was my duty to say those words, and after I did, a member of the press asked if I could repeat them so they could get it on camera. And I had to refuse because it wasn't a speech and it wasn't a play. It was the actual act of closing the polls. And you can't repeat that. So there is this particular element of voting which has this power. The goal of voting is to create change in the world by choosing and directing our politicians. When you cast your vote, you have right then and there contributed to that change in the world. Once your vote is cast, it has changed the world no matter how small it may seem at the time. Once you have inserted your ballot into the tabulator, it's a done deal. There is no going back. Your action and its effect have already happened. So when a minister and family and friends work together to prepare for a wedding, they have a duty to make sure that this religious ritual succeeds. The stakes are high. If the wedding goes as planned, two people will join together in joy for the rest of their lives. and this is a sacred duty. When a government employee and her coworkers join together to prepare for an election, they have a duty to make sure that this secular ritual succeeds, and the stakes are high. If the election goes as planned, the voice of the people will literally direct the events that happen in the political world. This duty may well be sacred. It is so important and so powerful that it cannot be kept at a level of the ordinary or the day-to-day. So if this is my understanding of the sacred in the democratic process and in governing, I will be at peace with that, but only on one condition. And that condition is that all of you who can participate in this most important of secular rituals a week from Tuesday. May it be so.